history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that really ought to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do that, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This time I'm in Denver, Colorado, at an American Legion Hall that has quite a bit of history itself, and the gentleman we're going to hear from has plenty of history to share. I mentioned the word education, too. That's been his life. In fact, that's kind of the family business. Glenn Stenson, 94 years old, of Denver, Colorado, our guest, a Navy veteran of World War II. But you're not from Denver originally, another part of Colorado that doesn't have quite as many people living in it?
Anyone that went through the years that I did, the Dirt Bowl and Depression and everything, and come out of that, still went on to win a war. Great people.
Tell us where your hometown in Colorado is and how to find it.
It's Holyoke, Colorado. It's 186 miles northeast of Denver. I actually grew up in a farming community of Amherst, Colorado, 10 miles northeast of Holyoke, until we moved into town when I was in the seventh grade.
And as the oldest of six kids in a farming community, that means you were probably working pretty hard, huh?
That junior do it. type thing, yeah. No, I was involved with the chores. Have to help Mom get the water hot for the clothes washing and take care of the chores and the pigs and the chickens and those things.
And I ask, it seems mundane, especially for someone who lived it, but I just think of people like your great-grandkids' age and the perspective that they have of growing up years is a little different. What was the toughest thing you had to do around the farm?
Oh, Lordy. Probably milk the little old Jersey cow whose teats were only an inch long.
You got to have good fingers for that.
You're a two-finger milker.
Do you remember, and these are the years, I mean, you said Dust Bowl and the Depression and all that. Can you help us understand what that was like, those of us who didn't live through economic times that were that dire?
Well, you know, as I think back on it, particularly when we got into school, well, first of all, I went to started out school in one-room school. One teacher and all the grades in there, and it was just a different time. The strictness, the discipline was something. You miss arithmetic problem, you're as bad as being in a Catholic school. You get your hands swatted. And then in Kansas one year, we were living with our grandparents because of the Depression. I went to a one-room school, and sometimes Grandpa would let me ride his horse to school, but usually my brother and I walked. But once the Dirt Bowl started, you'd get up and go to school in the morning. Sun would be shining at 9 o'clock. It'd be dark. Principal would say, kids, go home. So you go home, and the first thing you do when you get home, Mom hands you the water bucket and said, go down the windmill and get water. We'd soak the burlap sacks and sheets and everything in the water and hang it over the doors and the windows and everything else. Try to keep the dirt out of the house. You go to bed at night. When you woke up next morning, you knew just exactly where your head was because that was the only clean spot on the pillow.
Wow.
Those old houses, the heating wasn't good. In order to keep your feet warm at night, you'd heat rocks and put rocks wrapped in newspaper at the foot of the bed to keep your feet warm. It's just different. And yet, that was what we knew. We didn't know different.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, we just went along and we were happy. It was tough on the women, really tough on the women. But we kids, you know, we were kids.
I imagine when you go through something like that, you probably don't take a whole lot for granted in life.
No, you don't.
And I don't know if you remember this, it's been a long time, but when you were that kid dealing with those conditions, and as you said, you didn't know any different, no big deal. Do you remember having a dream or an ambition that thought of, hey, when I grow up someday, these are the things that I'm going to do or accomplish?
Well, I had thought when I was a kid that I'd like to be a doctor. Of course, those days, as you went through high school and that, and then the war came along and changed everything. Luckily, when I did get in the Navy, I got my second choice, which was hospital corps school, and became a corpsman in the Navy, which was going to be a step to being a doctor. But then I found out once I got out of the service, in those days, you pretty well had to have another doctor sponsor you. And that was tough. So that changed my whole career path.
Well, we're going to talk about some of that. I understand you weren't a bad athlete in high school? Played a lot of sports?
I was a tall, kind of a skinny kid. In fact, when I was a freshman, I was the littlest kid in the freshman class. By the time I was a senior, I was 5'10" and weighed a mighty 135 pounds. And we played the single wing, and coach kind of liked the way I could cross block. And so he made me the pulling guard in the single wing because I could go out and crack the defensive end. And then I was also the punter. I had to learn how to kick the hard way. One year for Christmas, my mother was expecting one of my younger brothers, and we were dirt poor and couldn't afford presents. Dad had found a football cover and no bladder or anything, so he filled it with rags. And my brother and all, that was my brother next to me, that was our present. Well, in order to not break my foot when I kicked the thing, I had to learn to kick it right. And so years later, that became a real funny thing with the kids I was coaching.
I bet. Did you ever break it out or make a replica of it for them to learn?
No, never did. But some of the kids I coached later on, they say, "Coach, we hated you." "You didn't hate me. What's the matter?" "We hated you on Thursday night when we had punt return drills, and you stepped back there and started doing the punting." Because I could kick 65, 70 yards.
Wow. When's the last time you tried?
15, 20 years ago.
And you still had it?
Not quite that far, no. But I could still get off a darn good spiral.
I believe it. We were talking before I started recording here. One of my favorite veterans that I've met here in the Rocky Mountain State was Lee Kaiser up in Julesburg, Colorado. He's preserved a ton of the local history there in his old Ford garage and museum. He was a high school rival of yours?
Yeah, he and I played against each other. He was from Julesburg. He and I played against each other in football and basketball.
Was that the big rivalry there, those two schools?
Oh,
or was there another one?
No, our big rivalry was Haxton, mm-hmm. 18 miles west of Holyoke. Yeah.
What would you say the population of Holyoke was before World War II?
About 1,300. I loved to play when I was a kid. Mainly my big sport was baseball. I started playing American Legion baseball when I was in freshman high school in 1939.
What position?
Usually an outfield.
Well, and now we have the Colorado Rockies. In fact, they just got their first Hall of Famer with Larry Walker. But back then, there was no Major League Baseball out this way.
No, but we've had good baseball in Colorado. We used to have a Denver Post tournament, bring guys all in, Satchel Paige, people like that come in, the old Kansas City Monarchs. No, we had some good baseball, semi-pro baseball in those days. And then it went to Class A, the old Denver Bears, and there are still a lot of people around Denver that remember the good old Denver Bears.
Well, what I was wondering was, you know, if you're the kid growing up in rural Colorado when there isn't a major league team with this big presence out here, who was your baseball hero back then?
The Dizzy yeah? Dean. Yeah, we had kids, we'd get together once in a while with our old taped up balls and taped up bats and try to choose up sides. Well, if you ate grape nut flakes, 3 box tops and a quarter, you could get a Dizzy Dean pin. Or if you ate grape nuts, 3 box tops and a quarter, you could get a Babe Ruth pin. Well, that's the way we chose up teams. And, you know, we were in our overalls and whatever. We didn't know what uniforms were. But we had fun. We played just as hard. And I sometimes think we learned our skills a little different because we had to learn them the hard way. We didn't have anyone teaching us.
Well, and I don't want to leave anything out from those years, but I know there's one thing I want to talk to you about because it changed your life. It changed your hometown, and it certainly changed the world. December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day and how you found out?
Well, I'd gone to church that morning, and right after church, I walked home, turned on the radio to a professional football game. The announcer was saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Japanese have bombed Pearl Harbor." And, of course, we had no knowledge of what was the damage that was being done to our hometown at that time. And, of course, we found out a couple of days later that we had lost 3 kids off my hometown of Holyoke on the Arizona. And right away, the emotions went high as soon as we can. We were going to go kill those people. We were going to go get even. And kids, people today, society, the correct society says, you can't say things like that. Well, you have to be true. And the truth was, we hated those people at that time, and we were going to go destroy them.
And when that happened, you were, I guess, a week shy of your 16th birthday, so you weren't old enough to go in yet. But you mentioned the 3 young men from your hometown mm-hmm. who were killed on the Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there are more than 2,400 Americans who were killed on Oahu that day.
Yeah.
1,177 on the Arizona. Is there something you'd like to share with us about those young men and who they were and maybe what their futures might have looked like?
Well, in the Depression, there were no jobs. So these guys would join the service, and a lot of them would join the Navy because of the glory, you know, getting away from dirt. And Richard Owens, the older one, would come back into town in his uniform. And, of course, we idolized how he looked in his navy whites. The other guy, Keith, he married a Holyoke girl, so he got classified as being from Holyoke. And Johnny Zeiler was an all-star athlete. He's probably one of the finest high school athletes in my mind that I ever saw in the state. You know, single wing, he could run, he could pass, he could kick. Basketball, he was all-state. Track, he could run the quarter mile. Whale of a softball pitcher. And he was just such a loss to us kids in terms of our idolizing that it really got us.
And just to put it in perspective for people listening, when you say one of the finest high school athletes you've ever seen in the state of Colorado, that comes after decades of coaching here in Colorado and also officiating football, yeah, basketball, and baseball,
yes,
in Colorado.
Yes.
So you've seen thousands of high school athletes.
Awesome.
So he was a guy you looked up to.
He was our idol. And his dad had the ice cream. They made the ice. And, of course, none of us had refrigerators, electric. So we would get the guy to come by with a block of ice, and we'd put it in. And, of course, people started to get electric refrigerators, and the ice business went down. And Johnny's dad just said, Johnny, I can't afford to pay you. So Johnny joined the Navy, and he happened to be in that unfortunate place.
And so you go from seeing these guys in their sparkling uniforms and saying, boy, that's really neat. You probably hadn't fathomed the idea that they could be killed like that, right?
No. Had no idea. We knew in high school we'd get current events paper. We knew somewhat was going on in Europe, and we knew about Lend-Lease and all those things, but it was so far removed from us. You know, without the emotional drive to get you into the service and go protect your country, it's just something that's hard to fathom, yes.
Were you thinking about it already, even at almost 16?
A little bit, but I thought a lot more of it when my dad joined the Seabees in 1942 and left my mom home with six kids. So then I joined the Navy in March of 43. I had my stuff from high school. They said I could graduate. So I went and left mom at home with five kids.
Hey, if dad can do it, I can do it too, huh?
Yeah.
And you can joke about it now, but how significant was that when your father is going off to war? And here you're at home as the oldest of six kids trying to help your mom survive.
I got very concerned. I don't know how it affected my other kids, the other brothers and sisters, but it began to bother me. And Dad had said he was going in so that us kids wouldn't have to go to war. And they did. Our population thought, oh, we'll whip those people in 6 months. It didn't work that way. And but we all began to think about it. We were going to probably have to go to the service.
And where did they send your dad? Where did he end up in the war?
My dad's CB unit was on the island invasion of Kwajalein. And then because of his age, when that all quieted down, they were starting to kick those old 45-year-old guys out of the service and send him home.
I'll ask you later about the time you got to see him during World War II after you were both wearing those Navy uniforms. And when you say, you know, you enlisted and you went in even before you were supposed to graduate high school.
Yes.
Was there any question in your mind about the branch of service you were going to choose? Was there a reason the Navy was your choice?
No doubt, Navy. I wanted no part of the mud.
Uh-huh.
And I thought the Navy offered more. I don't know.
And I'm just guessing that coming from northeastern Colorado, you'd never been on a ship before?
No, maybe a rowboat.
Uh-huh, a real raft in the river.
Yeah.
What was your welcome to the Navy experience, and did it match your expectations?
Well, you know, you're 17, you don't know anybody. I went in the Navy. Luckily, it was, I think, about a third of the University of Colorado football team. These guys are a little older, and a couple of those guys said, here, we got this young 17-year-old kid. We got to look after him. So those guys did. They looked after me through boot camp and all, and they're lifelong friends, and I don't know how it would have been if I hadn't had them kind of take me by the hand and go along. And then, of course, as I got a little farther in the service and got into hospital corps school, where I had to study like mad, because we were in school studying all different branches and phases of medicine from 7 in the morning till 6 at night, and then we still had to study. You begin to not look at a lot of other things, you're buried in your studies. So then you began to look forward to your next assignments, what's going to happen.
Where was your core school?
Farragut, Idaho. You know where that is?
I've talked to a lot of vets who trained there.
Most beautiful lake in the United States, 40 miles north of Coeur d'Alene. still pristine. The Navy still has a secret sonar base there. When we got to Farragut, 15 inches of snow on the ground. We marched through the snow, and then, of course, with all the lava rock around up there, it melts off pretty fast.
Were you eager to be deployed to go help in this effort? Were you anxious about it? What do you remember?
Well, I wanted to get out of the routine of Corps school, so my first assignment was Naval Hospital, Seattle.
And you'll hear about what he did there when we come back. Glenn Stenson of Denver, Colorado is our guest today. Still to come, the unique way he helped the wounded from one of the Pacific's biggest battles, and his connection to survivors of World War II's worst sea disaster. Find photos of Glenn then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myEECU.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myEECU.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 94-year-old Glenn Stenson of Denver, Colorado, originally from the small town of Holyoke in northeastern Colorado near the Nebraska border. His father was already in the Navy when Glenn, the oldest of six children, signed up at age 17. After training to be a hospital corpsman, his first assignment was at Naval Hospital, Seattle.
Well, they were getting us guys assigned to specific jobs. We were on kind of an outgoing unit, and my job at that time was to ride in the old Chrysler ambulances down to Pier 91 and unload the kids coming in from Guadalcanal. Then they got situated, and I ended up, my assignment was down in the brig. My assignment was to make sure the extreme psychos got their medications. And they were guys that couldn't be taken care of in a regular psycho ward. Yeah, a couple of pretty good experiences in there that kind of tainted me for life. Not negatively, but I just saw what can happen to people's minds under that kind of stress.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I wanted to ask you about that. And just hearing you say that first you're unloading these wounded Marines from Guadalcanal, so you're seeing the physical effects of war.
Yes.
I mean, you probably saw some things you'd never seen before.
Right.
Missing limbs?
Mm-hmm.
Bad wounds to different parts of the body?
Brains half gone.
I mean, you're what, 18 years old now?
17, yep, just 17.
How do you digest something like that? How do you process it?
You go to church.
Hmm.
It was one thing I was proud of. I can't think of very many Sundays in the 3+ years I was in the Navy that I'd missed a church service.
So you see these physical wounds. You know those guys are going to get help. And then they say, you're in the brig, and...
I mean, I'm probably standing. When are you going to pull a sail door off? Because those sails weren't all built all that good. Thankfully, we had Marine guards there in case someone got too violent. They'd take care of that. But I was over there, Naval Hospital, there for 3 months.
I think we could tell just from what you said about it, this was extremely difficult for a teenager. Can you help us understand some of the things you saw or witnessed?
We had a young man in the Navy that jumped ship down in New Caledonia, I guess, about the time of the invasion of Guadalcanal. They were bringing him back to the States to court-martial him, and they got somehow or another in Pearl Harbor, he jumped ship. How he got loose, I don't know. Well, they caught him again down in New Caledonia. And bringing him back to the States, I have no idea what happened. But by the time I got him in the brig. He was a vegetable. Couldn't talk. He was a baby. I had to take care of him like he was a little baby. Had to feed him with liquids. His dad would sit in the jail cell begging him, you know, to remember his mother do that. But how a man's mind can snap that fast, that got to me.
Sure. Well, and that's something that I think in recent years we're starting to hear more and more about, the mental, psychological, emotional wounds of war, that it can be just as significant. And I guess you got exposed to it probably earlier than most.
Yeah.
So you spend 3 months at the hospital, and then they send you to Gonzaga University?
Mm-hmm. The medical dispensary there for 10 months and kind of independent duty. We didn't have a doctor on duty with us every day. And we were kind of on our own making the decisions, you know. If a guy's got measles, we have to put in records the guy had possible measles. And today, every now and then, some guy will go in wanting some after effects of measles while he was in the service, and they'll say, "We're not sure you had measles because your record just says possible."
And that's your fault?
Well, we weren't doctors, so we couldn't make a concrete diagnosis.
And these are, again, your patients are?
They were students at Gonzaga University. They were in pre-officer, pre-flight training. After 10 months there, I was sent back to Newport, Rhode Island to join a new ship's crew for orientation and getting ready while the ship was being completed down in Brooklyn.
So you're a plank owner?
I'm a plank owner of the USS Tranquility, which was a big, nice, beautiful hospital ship.
So finally,
I'm on the water.
Yeah, you finally get out on the ocean. How'd you take to that?
You know, I never got seasick. In fact, well, part of the problem, summertimes I'd spent driving Caterpillar tractors for farmers, so I was used to the jiggling and the jangling. A lot of the guys would get seasick on the first time they hit a wave, but it never bothered me, and I loved it. I did. I loved the water.
You know, we hear a lot about aircraft carriers and cruisers and battleships and destroyers and every other kind of ship. We don't hear a whole lot about a hospital ship. How big was the Tranquility? What was the complement? What can you tell us about life aboard that ship?
Life is just like maybe in any hospital, except we were confined out there on the water. We couldn't get out and go, but we had a complete medical staff, surgeries and everything. We had two crews. The one crew ran the ship, and the other crew was the medical. And we had about 250 medical and about 225 deck people. And then our 250 medical people, of course, were there was 30 nurses plus the doctors, and we could hold 800 patients, so we were a busy thing. So our first obligation over in the Pacific was Okinawa, and it didn't take us very long to get loaded up, and most of our patients were Marines. We'd have a few. And most of the guys we got were lung and abdominal wounds so that they could get the doctors pretty well paired, specialists, and they could make better use of the personnel.
Well, and I want to talk to you about that, and we know how bloody Okinawa was and what great degree of casualties were absorbed there. But when you said you had 30 nurses, I'm thinking all the sailors I've talked to who served in the Pacific, none of them had women on their ships.
That's right.
I bet those 30 nurses were popular.
Didn't do us any good. They were officers and we were enlisted. Maybe the doctors made out, I don't know. But,
So what kinds of things did you do as a hospital corpsman there on the Tranquility?
Well, you know, in hospital corps school, we cover the whole area of medicine, pharmacology, laboratory. We were trained to do anything we would need to do in medicine without a doctor. And part of that was dietetics. And I don't know how they did it, but my job was I was head of the special diets kitchen, doing special diets for prescribed certain patients had to have certain medicines, certain foods. Mm-hmm. And that was my job. I had one other corpsman under me, and we would, I can't remember how many we'd do a day, but at Okinawa we were doing plenty. We'd make a run down to Pearl Harbor and unload those and back to Okinawa, and we did that a couple of times.
How much did you get to interact with those wounded Marines, with the casualties from this Battle of Okinawa?
Not too much, because it was too busy.
So you saw the condition they were in, but didn't get to know them.
Yeah, we went through that, and then after Okinawa, we were sent down to a beautiful anchorage called Ulithi, where all the fleet was gathering for the invasion of Japan. We were the lead hospital facility, and the aircraft carriers loaded with Marines in the harbor sent those guys over to our ship, and they'd all day long, it'd be a line of guys coming up one side of the quarterdeck across and down the other, and as fast as they walked across the quarterdeck, they were getting hit with shots, getting their shots for the Oriental things. we had a bunch of us in our spare time. We had formed a band. We ended up with a 16-piece dance band. And we were playing for the crew one evening and got a message that we had to take off. And we went down to a place called Peleliu. And when we got down there, we found out that our job was to receive the survivors off the USS Indianapolis that the Eel Destroyer escorts were bringing in. We ended up, out of the 312, I think, that survived, we ended up with, I think, 167 of them on our ship. They weren't in very good shape.
As I try to imagine myself in your shoes, so here you are at Okinawa, you're not even 20 years old yet.
No.
And you're doing this day after day after day. I imagine that it was a pretty exhaustive pace, right?
Well, I get out of... Because of my role, I had to prepare the menu for the week. I had to keep track of the budget. People don't understand this, but even during war, I had 85 cents a day per patient at that time. And if I wanted to go a little extra on the holiday, I'd have to cut that down. So most of the time it was 75 cents so that on holiday I could give them a little more. And it was, pretty much of a rote thing because I'd get up somewhere between 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning. I usually get to bed somewhere between 10:30 and 11. I was getting pretty tired.
And you're not interacting, as you said, too much with these wounded Marines.
No, because my station was down below deck, and all the hospital beds were up on the upper decks.
But you have a responsibility, just as anyone else on that ship, of keeping those guys alive.
Yeah.
And you know what kind of shape they're in.
Mm-hmm.
What should we know about those guys? The guys that you were caring for, that you were trying to help survive what they'd been through. What should we know about them today?
What they were doing, I would say that the big majority of them felt that they were freeing the world of some bad people, that they were protecting the people at home so they wouldn't have to go through something like that again. We all hoped that when that war was over, that was going to be the end of it. That was the future. Get back. Want to get home, get back going. Worrying about getting ready to go to college, if you're going to go to college or whatever it was. And maybe if you're lucky, you still had a girl back home waiting for you.
Well, and you shared how your small hometown in northeastern Colorado lost 3 young men on the very first day of the war. So I'm sure that gravity had always been there with you. But when you saw those Marines that your ship is treating, do you ever look at them and say, hey, that could have happened to me? I could be in that place?
I would watch them bring a... I might go up on the quarterdeck to get some fresh air, and I'd watch them bring kids 150 at a time out in the landing crafts and hoist them up on the wood planks, up to get them up and get them on the ship 150 at a time. And this would go on, for several hours a day, until we were loaded. And then sometimes some of the guys that weren't as bad off as others, we'd transfer them over to an auxiliary hospital ship so we could stay there longer and pick up more serious ones. But you just, in my case, I just didn't get a chance to go up and talk to those guys all that much.
And I guess I should ask, I don't usually think this way, but I'm just trying to imagine what it was like to be you. We know what happened. We know in hindsight, the victory that was achieved. We know the cost of the victory as well. But being so close to the casualties, seeing that firsthand, were you ever concerned that this war might not be going the way of the Allies, that it could swing the other way?
We were pretty confident out in the Pacific for the most part after Midway that we had control of the seas. And, of course, our airmen controlled the air. And we felt pretty good about it. In fact, we sailed when we were going down to get the survivors off the Indianapolis. We went by the most heavily fortified Japanese island in the Pacific, Yap Island. We had picked up some Merchant Marine guys that were on patients on the ship, and we were going down to get the Indianapolis kids. And those guys got nervous as all get out because, as a hospital ship, we had to stay lit 24 hours a day, Geneva Convention. And we sailed within Yap Island. They had their lights on. We had our lights on.
Well, if I were in their shoes, I might be a little nervous too. Well, and before you picked up the Indianapolis guys, you told us you're preparing for the invasion of Japan. And I've had so many veterans say, I was going to be part of the invasion. The atomic bomb saved my life. We've heard that story a lot. But you're giving us a glimpse into how close to that happening things were, that your ship is inoculating all these Marines because they're about to go ashore and deal with these potential diseases as well as the enemy.
Well, and after we picked up the Indianapolis and kids from the Indianapolis, we took them to Guam. We went back down to the anchorage. Where's all the ships? they'd all taken off for the north. So we had to sail like mad and get in our position on ships sailing up and down in the Japanese Sea getting ready for the invasion. And we were going to be the lead hospital facility. But the war ended and we didn't get to go into Tokyo Bay. They sent one of the other hospital ships, so we missed that.
And as far as the Indianapolis, now some people listening know the story. It's been the subject of many books, including a recent New York Times bestseller. But I'm curious for you guys, because the tragedy of the Indianapolis is that they're sunk by this Japanese submarine, I-58, after they've delivered the atomic bomb to Tinian. But nobody knows. For 3 days, nobody knows that they're gone. So what were the first things that you guys heard, and when did it sink in what had happened to these guys?
The first thing we heard was when we got down to Palau, they told us who these guys were. It was total secrecy. I don't know why they did it that way, but they did it. And, of course, even then, the kids on the Indianapolis, they never knew what they hauled over to Tinian. They didn't know they'd hauled the A-bomb. And even when we got them to Guam, when we unloaded them off the ship, there was a huge chain-link fence around here with Marine guards about every 5 feet so that the press couldn't get there. Admiral Nimitz had strict 100% silence. And even after we'd rescued them, they had no idea what they'd done.
Well, and they say that in the sinking of that cruiser, the Indianapolis, only about 300 were killed in the initial sinking.
Right.
Then the rest are floating. They don't know if they're going to be rescued. The worst shark attack in recorded history is taking place. So these guys are being eaten by sharks, or they're starving. They're drinking salt water and hallucinating.
Even committing suicide, because when the little destroyer escorts started to get to them, a big ship couldn't get at them. The water was too rough and everything. These little ships had to get in there and pick them up. But they'd see one of these little destroyer escorts coming and they'd be hallucinating. There was a Japanese coming to get them, so they'd slit their throat and commit suicide.
One of the most tragic circumstances anyone's ever learned about anywhere. But I'm curious, since you guys now are their caretakers, what kind of shape were those sailors in?
Well, when they were coming on board our ship, one of my jobs was to assign them to beds. I was on a quarter deck, and they would look at their hands and one thing or another, their sunburn, their hands and skin, their arms, whatever was exposed. They were in horrible shape. You'd just touch a hand or grab them of the arm and the skin would just peel right off. Captain McVeigh came on board. He was the captain that was court-martialed. Came on board, and our doctors wanted to take care of him. And he said, no, not until I've checked on all my boys. So, and of course, then nutrition-wise, coming to me then, my diet kitchen, we had to come up with a lot of custard, soup, and soft foods for the 6 days. We had them going from Peleliu up to Guam. Very few of them could eat solid food.
Yeah, the trauma on there. Digestive systems was severe.
Yeah.
You're the only one who can tell us that story, so I'm really glad that you did.
Well, you know, there's only 10 of those guys left.
That's right. One of them just passed away
a couple weeks ago. The last officer.
And you brought up Captain McVeigh. I'm glad you did, because he became the scapegoat for this situation.
Yep. Maybe it sounds far-fetched, but I like in his story the way the parents that caused him to commit suicide. Today we have these people whose kids get in trouble or one thing or another, and they go to the TV and blame the policeman for killing their kids. Kind of almost parallel.
And for those who don't know the story, he was court-martialed. They say he should have been zigzagging. Years later, it comes out that wasn't necessarily true. And you're saying, you're giving us a glimpse of where his heart was, that he's refusing medical treatment to make sure the young men under his command are getting it. Obviously, you knew later on that he did kill himself with the grief and the harassment and everything. So I'm curious for you, in more recent years, when that court martial was overturned, when he was exonerated, was that significant for you to hear?
Oh, yes. It meant a lot because it was a course of justice finally prevailed. But it took a middle school kid to start all the whole education in Florida. It was a middle school kid that got things going to get him exonerated.
Yeah, Hunter Scott of Pensacola, Florida. He was only 12 years old when he was turned onto that quest as part of a National History Day project. He ended up testifying before Congress, and Captain McVeigh was posthumously exonerated 55 years after the Indianapolis tragedy. It's time for another break, but there's much more to come with 94-year-old Glenn Stenson of Denver, Colorado. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 94-year-old Glenn Stenson of Denver, Colorado. If you played high school football, basketball, or baseball in Colorado, there's a chance Glenn might have officiated one of your ball games. He did all three sports for decades in addition to coaching and teaching. But first, he had to make it through World War II. A corpsman aboard the hospital ship USS Tranquility, he told us about nearly a week spent helping survivors of the tragic sinking of the USS Indianapolis. And I've got a few more questions about that. I do want to suggest, if you haven't yet read the New York Times bestseller Indianapolis by Lynn Vinson and Sarah Vladek, it is outstanding and it'll give you even greater context to what Glenn's sharing today.
You mentioned the secrecy aspect. Was there anything that you guys gleaned in that 6 days around the survivors about what had happened?
None. We just knew that they'd been torpedoed. We didn't know about the A-bomb or any of that. So we were just as innocent babes in the wood, just like the kids that were survivors.
So I'm just guessing it must have been fascinating for you in all the years that followed as information came out and you learn about the shark attack and you learn about the significance of the mission and all that.
I had the privilege of attending a couple of many reunions and getting to know some of those guys. So the ones that I got to know, I think there's one left. And they had some very interesting stories. And, of course, we were fortunate that the president of the Indianapolis Survivors Association lived here in the Denver area all these years, and he and I used to go to schools talking to kids about different things about the Indianapolis and World War II, and that Paul Murphy. Mm-hmm. And he just passed away a couple of years ago.
I'm glad that you shared that. So you mentioned going to the reunions. What was that like when you met some of these guys all these years after the war?
I would find out which ones were on the Tranquility, and we'd have a visit. And, of course, one guy always said, man, the Tranquility, that was the ship with all those beautiful women. He was a little guy from Virginia. I can't think of his name.
Well, most people don't have that opportunity. I mean, of all the medical folks in the war who treated so many people, usually they don't know if someone lived or died or what their life turned out to be. To see these guys who you helped save in a real crisis situation, I'm guessing that must have been satisfying for you.
Well, yes, and there's a scholarship fund out of Wisconsin that was started for the benefit of the kids and grandchildren of survivors in Indianapolis, and I think it's worthwhile. And I have supported that scholarship fund for years, and some of those guys passed their history down pretty good.
When I hear you say that, I guess what strikes me, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like seeing them back in 1945 and understanding some of what they'd gone through stirred some real compassion inside of you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, always will.
But you weren't done, as you said. You race back up, and you don't make it to Tokyo Bay because they don't need you anymore.
Well, we had got our rudder on our ship damaged in a typhoon. They felt that we couldn't steer well enough to go into Little Tokyo Bay, so they sent us back down to Okinawa to get some kids out of a hospital, and they sent another hospital ship in that ended up getting the old captured general from Corregidor. They got him. I would love to have got him.
Well, hearing your sentiments at the start of the war, I'm sure you would have in that circumstance, but I can't gloss over that comment either. If your rudder got bent in a typhoon, you must have felt that typhoon a little bit.
Some kids at the Air Force Academy asked me a couple of years ago, what experience did you have on a hospital ship? And as a corpsman, it was most dangerous. And being we were lit 24 hours a day and had a few kamikazes take a shot at us at Okinawa. And I said, to be real frankly, I was so afraid. I was afraid we were going to roll over in that typhoon with 800 kids. And I said, you know, that night I made a very definite commitment to my God. And these kids, there's about 40 Air Force kids around me, and they said, thank you, sir, for mentioning the word God. That's the position they're in today.
So the typhoon was?
That was before we went to Peleliu. It was while we were at Okinawa during the fighting, what was going on. But we'd had that damaged rudder, and I guess didn't realize how bad it was until we got in dry dock for a week in Pearl Harbor one time, and they found it.
And I want to come back to the typhoon in a second, but I don't want to forget something else you said. You had a couple kamikazes come close to the Tranquility?
No, they didn't get, they were heading at us, but we had to stay at least 10 miles from all of the ships because we were lit. Mm-hmm. And they had about five little destroyer escorts that circled us constantly, and these kamikazes never got within 5 miles of us.
So they were heading your way because they could see your lights, but they got shot down.
They did get a couple hospital ships. They really nailed one bad in the Philippines.
Yeah, the big red cross on the side wasn't going to save you, huh?
No, it was a target.
And the typhoon, where were you while your ship is going through this typhoon?
I went down and got my bunk. I was hanging on for dear life because that was a horrible night. Thank God we had a good captain. He kept the ship pointed in the right direction all night long, and we could hear that propeller come out of the water and go flop, 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 back down in the water. And if we'd ever got caught sideways in those big swells, we'd have rolled over and been gone.
But it had to be a pretty jiggly ride for you in that bed.
Not bad. Like I said, I was praying.
You were praying. That sounds like a desperate prayer.
Well, it was. St. Elmo, patron saint of the water, calling this thing down.
It sounds like you weren't just praying for yourself.
Oh, there's a lot of kids.
You're thinking about 800 wounded.
Well, plus the crew.
Uh-huh. And I've talked to a lot of guys who've shared, you know, they made a bargain with God. Louis Zamperini comes to mind. A lot of people know his story.
I met Lou Zamperini at one time.
Uh-huh.
I was running a quarter mile and a half mile in college, and we had the regional AAU and Olympic trials at DU. They brought Lou in as a guest. He wasn't running or anything, but they brought him as a gift. So I did. I get to meet him, shake his hand, didn't get to talk to him. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, another one of those old contemporary runners of the 30s, Glenn Cunningham, that ran against Lou a lot, but Glenn was basically a miler. Glenn Cunningham used to come travel around the schools a lot, and I had a number of visits with him when he'd come to the schools where I was teaching in Rocky Ford, Colorado, and he'd talk to the school kids about cigarettes, smoking, and alcohol and tobacco. Mm-hmm. Glenn was a good man.
Well, and I don't want to pry. Don't share anything you don't want to, but when you tell me something like that, I'm interested in how that has translated for the last 75 years. So this is 1945. You're making a deal with God. What was the fine print? What was the bargain you made?
Serving. So all the work I've done in my life, all the jobs I've had have always been a service-type job, whether it's teaching school, running a park and recreation district, or being a field representative for the American Cancer Society. Those things have been a service. And then the work I do with the church and here at the American Legion, I've spent many, many hours working with veterans, helping veterans out. And then one of the things I really enjoy doing is going to schools and talking to school kids. This last Veterans Day, for instance, I talked to over 1,000 school kids in about 3 days. So that's my joy, is going back to see the kids.
How long have you been doing that?
Oh, I've been doing that, I guess, probably the last 35 years more than before.
Wow. How long are you going to keep doing it?
Well, as long as I can walk 2.5-3 miles a day, I'll keep going back.
And at 94, you're still on that pace. Well, and I guess I can't ask you those questions without asking, especially since I know there are a lot of young people listening right now. When you go speak to these big crowds of school kids who, I mean, they're the same age you were when you went into the Navy, or maybe some are the same age when you heard about three guys from your hometown dying at Pearl Harbor on the Arizona. What's the message that you share with those young people?
Well, basically, be honest, be loyal, look out for one another. I get questions, you know, every older kids, middle school, high school. What do you think about the A-bomb? I mean, I have to tell a little different story. The A-bomb was horrible, but this kid said, what do you think about the A-bomb? And I said, I have to tell you my side of it, the way I see it, because nobody talks about it. A-bomb was horrible. We might have had to drop another one if we had it. But the big thing was the Japanese government, the emperor, knew that if we ever started to invade, his island would be firebombed flat by General LeMay's bombers. Firebombs. We had already destroyed half of Tokyo with firebombs. Mm-hmm. We had destroyed another 13 villages with firebombs. It was going to be horrible. we'd have killed millions and millions more with firebombs than we ever did with the A-bomb. And these kids will look at me kind of, we didn't know that. It's not in your book.
And, of course, famously, they estimated upwards of 1 million American casualties if that invasion had taken place as well, which would have been more than twice what had already happened in the war to that point in all fronts.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of things come to mind, and we haven't even touched on everything you've done after the war in education as a PE teacher, as a wrestling coach, cross-country coach, football coach, name the sport, you coached it, you officiated it, which means you have great patience if you were an official for that many years in that many sports.
Don't tell my wife about patience.
When you look back, and you just told us, you know, you shared your heart to serve others, your fellow veterans, to serve future generations. What are you most proud of, or what are you most thankful for?
That I did it honestly, that I did it loyally, and I did it out of my own heart.
And when I asked you what you share with those kids, you focused on character. You focused on the things that you would want them to emulate. When it comes to understanding the history, which I can tell you know as well as anybody, you lived a lot of it, but you've learned a lot of the stuff you didn't live firsthand. What do you think the young people alive today and future generations of Americans need to know about your generation and what you all did?
Well, first of all, our nation's built on history. The world is built on history. But unfortunately, in order to water down and get these kids into this modern-day social life of political correctness and that type of thing, we have thrown the key things in history that made our nation break. The kids don't know it. They don't get it. And the only way they can get it is if we veterans can get to these schools and talk to the kids. I talked to them about bullying even. Last Veterans Day, I was in the elementary school, and I had a bunch, 12 other veterans with me, there with their grandkids in the school and one thing or another. And that day, I don't know why, it hit me. I said, okay, all you kids stand up, raise your right hand. No, son, your right hand. That's some little kids with the left. I say it after me, and the veterans will. And we did the oath that they take to go into the service. I said, when you grow up and go into the service, this is what you will say. And our color guard was there, and they said, it was amazing to watch the reaction of those kids. It was just something I did on a spur of the moment.
Well, and if there's anything that I left out, you know, feel free to add it in. But I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country.
Paul, I appreciate what you're doing to help spread the word. I'd love to do those.
Well, I realize there's one other thing, well, two now, because I saw your honor flight pin on your hat. But one that I wanted to ask you about, your father went in the Navy ahead of you, beat you to the punch. The whole duration of World War II, you guys saw each other exactly once.
Once. That was when I had boot camp leave, and he was on his way to Hawaii, then to Kwajalein.
So you both came home back to Holyoke at the same time?
Yeah, except he kind of got mad at me. I walked in. It was June 28th. I'll never forget it. I said, happy birthday, Dad. He says, what's the matter with you? My birthday is June 24th. Never forgot that.
How do you think he felt about you being out there risking your life?
I think he worried. Of course, both he and I, our thoughts were on Mom at home with those kids. Again, out of the Depression, not a lot of money, and her with five kids and Dad's Navy allotment. I was going to try and save some money with my extra I had in the service, and Mom would write me a letter, and she'd say, sorry, Junior, I had to use your money. So I come home in the service without any savings. But it meant my brothers and sisters had food. So, sadly, our family wasn't the only one in that boat, I'm sure.
Yeah. And of the six kids, five of you became teachers.
Yes.
What was your getting back to Holyoke, your homecoming? What was that like?
Well, I got off the bus 8 o'clock in the morning and my duffel bag and my trumpet and walked home. And I was still in my Navy uniform. And Dad was in his Navy uniform. I said, what are you doing? He says, don't change clothes. And I said, why? He says, we have a military funeral this morning. You're going to have to play taps. So that was my, I hadn't even, I had a chance hardly to say hi to Mom or anything. So we had this, but it was a dear friend of mine that had got pneumonia on a troop ship coming home in the Pacific and died.
Died on his way home from the war.
Yeah.
Awful. And you had to go over there and play taps on the spot.
Yeah, and I played taps for a lot of funerals through the years. Down in Rocky Ford, where I was teaching, coaching, the principal come down to the field house and say, got to run out to cemetery right quick and play taps. I'll cover your class for you. I'd go out and blow taps, come back.
I saw on your World War II veteran hat, you've got a nice red pin that says Rocky Mountain Honor Flight.
Yes.
What was that like for you to go back and see the National World War II Memorial?
Wonderful. My honor flight, we had 12 Air Force cadets from the academy with us that were to interview us and do historical studies. So we spent quite a bit of time there at the World War II Memorial, and the 4,000 gold stars really sink in. Then there was a middle school band from Iowa playing a concert, and that helped kind of stir the juice a little more. Went on, and most people don't realize that when they go there, there's a kiosk up above that you can go in. If you were in the service, you can get registered your name and your address and everything. My dad and I are both in that kiosk. And then, of course, we went around to the other monuments and one thing and another. And after we'd been up the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, we were around waiting for our bus to come. Kids from middle schools, California and Georgia and all that. Sir, can we have our pictures taken with you guys? Can we shake your hands? Would you sign our programs? And I said, I'm going to cross the road. I knew why I was going. Got over there, and here's this ordinary tomb with a lot of flowers by it. I'm standing there, and the kid says, what are this? And I said, see that name? Well, what about it? I said, that name is Audie Murphy, most decorated soldier out of World War II. Those kids, then they wanted to know about Audie Murphy.
One more question on that. You said those 4,000 gold stars really sink in. Of course, they represent 406,000 Americans who died in the war. So I'm just curious, was there anyone or anything specific that came to mind while you were staring at that giant wall of gold stars?
Oh, I could see pictures I served with, pictures of all the guys from home that had probably gone to service, because we had a pictorial book put out home of all the wee guys in the service. Just all those visions, just a lot of things run through your mind. You can't really narrow it on one.
And I'm just curious, I'm not putting words in your mouth again, but you told me about during the typhoon what you were doing. You were talking to God. I'm just curious, if being at a place like the World War II Memorial, do you end up talking to God some more?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and more so over at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. All those monuments are wonderful. World War II, Vietnam. I tell everybody that the one memorial you want to see at night is the Korean Memorial. The way they treated those statues, and they light them up at night, it's like a bunch of ghosts coming across the field at you.
It's haunting. It really is.
It is haunting, yeah. I have always said that we waste a lot of money in this country, and we really blew it on lousy educational plans that go nowhere. I would a lot rather see our Congress give each state so many millions of dollars a year to send every middle school to Washington, D.C. or to Boston. They do that in Europe. If I ever won the big $350 million lotto, that's what it
I'm not sure which option the odds favor more, that funding source or the congressional idea, but the source of this idea and the example he continues to set at age 94 should be enough for the powers that be to consider what he's saying. I can't sign off today without thanking American Legion Post 1 in Denver for allowing us to record this program there in one of Glenn Stenson's favorite spots. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.